And I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, Texas, a cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station, a rather unique radio station, unique in the country. Our show is syndicated. We're rebroadcast on WFTE in Mount Cobb in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and on KPFT in Houston on their HD3 channel. We are produced in the Co-op studios in association with the Rag Blog and the New Journalism Project, and all of our shows are put up as podcasts at the Internet Archive. Rag Radio is produced, as is the Rag Blog, in the spirit of the 60s underground press. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Yeah. And Tracy, it's cold outside.
It's a little chilly for Austin, for sure.
Yeah. It's been cold and wet. And of course, for those of you who are in, say, Anchorage or Alaska, or as I think my guest is, I'm not sure where Gus is. Where are you, Gus? Are you in Vermont?
Central Vermont.
Central Vermont. I bet it's cold there, too.
Well, night before last, it got down to minus 25.
Okay, so we have no reason to cry. We have no reason to whine. Although, we will whine about one thing. And that is the fact that we now have a governor of Texas now has a governor who's well to the right of Rick Perry. And we have a lieutenant governor who's well to the right of Attila the Hun. So hopefully they'll be so bad that they'll create a backlash and we'll have a progressive revival. So,
well, it's amazing how these things happen, isn't it?
It truly is.
You wonder who was asleep at the switch. I know there's been a movement to, strengthen progressivism in Texas.
Yes, there has. And Texas is a tale of two, well, I was going to say two cities, but a tale of two peoples. I mean, it's urban Texas is really very progressive. Austin, of course, is a progressive city. And Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, El Paso are all essentially Democratic cities. So Texas is not one thing, but Texas is so gerrymandered. And with the restrictive voting regulations and everything else, the voter suppression, I don't think that who runs Texas truly represents who lives in Texas. But that's not to say that there isn't a lot of reactionary thought in this state. Before we go on, by the way, I do want to say, and help me with this if out there if I don't do it right, but here at Rag Radio, je suis Charlie. Okay?
I think you did that well.
Right,
thank you
there,
very much.
There you go.
Okay. All right. My guest, who you've already heard from, is one of the most significant, well, as Bill McKibben, certainly a noted environmentalist, says, is the great that Gus, James Gustav Speth, who from now on will be Gus, and to him already is the great environmentalist of our age. And he's has a remarkable history. We will talk about his resume, which he discusses in his new book, sometimes with a bit of distance and sort of a bit of tongue-in-cheek about it, or not, you know, personalizes it. But his new memoir, Gus's new memoir, is Angels by the River, Reflections on Race, Environment, Politics, and Living on the Front Lines of Change. Van Jones calls it a critical book for change agents, young and old. Angels by the River follows Speth's unlikely path from a southern boyhood to his career as an influential mainstream environmentalist to his current system-changing activism. Gus, and here's the resume part. Gus Speth founded the Natural Resources Defense Council and World Resources Institute, which was right at the very beginning of the environmental movement in this country. He was an environmental advisor to Presidents Carter and Clinton, was chair of the United Nations Development Group, and was dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. He currently teaches at Vermont Law School and is senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, distinguished senior fellow with Demos, and associate fellow with the TELUS Institute. You have to stop there because we could go on and on. And I would like to add that in 2011, Gus Speth was arrested in front of the White House for protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. I want to talk about the book in just a second and about how its trajectory parallels your life story and how well you sort of create an interaction between those two in order to, I think, give us a tale of not only racism in the South, not only the evolution, the beginning and evolution of the environmental movement, but also and the radicalization of the environmental movement, or the necessary radicalization, but also the radicalization, even though you say that you don't really consider yourself a radical. I think you probably truly fit the description, the radicalization of a young Southern boy who becomes one of our most important environmentalists and now sees that the problem is basically systemic and that we have to address basic causal factors. All right, but before all of that, and I don't know if how accurate all of that was or how you, but
we made it all up.
We made it all up. I thought so. I thought it was the Onion if it wasn't Charlie. Okay, but before we get into the book, to something that's in the news right now, and since you were arrested in a demonstration in front of the White House, which I guess marked your turn in the direction of civil disobedience, the Keystone Pipeline is actually the first issue that the new Republican Congress wants to push through, and President Obama has said that he will veto it. I want to know two things. This is a two-parter. One is, and in fact, it might end up being multiple. I have a way of asking questions that sort of involve could maybe take the whole show to respond to. But one is that I want to know how important you think the Keystone Pipeline is. Is it essentially a symbolic issue, but a significant one? And how important is it that Obama is? How important will it be if he vetoes it? And then part two is, I want to know what you think Obama's environmental legacy will be.
Right. Well, thank you, Thorne. The Keystone is extraordinarily important in sort of signaling a direction. We either get deeper and deeper into the fossil fuel hole and develop more and more forms of extreme fossil fuel energy, which, you know, tar sands is a leading example, or we begin to move away, and we should have been moving away for a long time. I want to talk about that in a minute. And so this is really a sort of bellwether. Are we going to mire ourselves even more deeply in this gravest of all threats that we face today, I honestly believe, climate change, or are we going to begin to do the right thing and begin to put us on a track that will leave a pleasant world to our children and grandchildren? So I think it's that. It's also a threat to those who live along the pipeline and various aspects of it. And I know that in Texas and elsewhere along the proposed routes, there have been demonstrations and people protesting, and they're very concerned about what it will mean for them. I noticed that we also had a big development, I think maybe it was even just today or yesterday, that the Nebraska Supreme Court, which had been a pending case that was holding it up, had cleared the way for the pipeline to go ahead, unfortunately. So that comes in addition to the congressional momentum. But I also think that, you know, one of our leading climate scientists, Jim Hansen, is absolutely right when he said if we really go, you know, start allowing these tar sands to be developed, it's game over for the climate. I mean, it's a serious resource there, and there's a myth that if we don't allow the pipeline, well, Canada will find some other way to get it out. That's not really clear at all. This thing is being fought in Canada, both in the east and the west, and the native peoples in Canada are up in arms about it, and it's so there's a real possibility that we can, you know, button down this this resource, and it relates to the larger picture, you know, which is that there are estimates that anyway from, you know, 20% to 80% of the fossil resource, known fossil resource on the books of fossil fuel companies, is going to have to stay in the ground if we do the right thing to deliver a safe and sustaining climate to future generations. So this is, it would be both an indication and also a very important substantive thing for climate if it were denied. I actually think Obama's going to keep up the fight against it that he's now joined. He didn't for a long time. He stayed on the fence. He did not have a strong record on the climate issue in the first 6 years of his administration. They talked about it. I think it's kind of like a weak radio signal. You know, it would come in, and then all of a sudden it would disappear, and then it would come back. But he didn't consistently do the things that we needed on the climate front. But I think he sees it now as part of his legacy. I think he's sincere about going for climate protection. He's doing what he can do under the authorities that he has, recognizing that the darn Congress isn't going to do anything positive, anyhow. And so I give him credit for joining the issue late, but, but as we say, better late than never.
Well, we can't deny that he seems to be an emboldened man since in recent days in terms of the number of the actions he's taken. And we hope that will, of course, continue. What about his overall legacy?
Well, overall, I think he has a good record. Given the circumstances.
We always have to put that in, don't we?
We do. I was with the Natural Resources Defense Council for almost a decade, and they're still, they have a big Washington operation that aimed at trying to get the administration and the agencies and the Congress to do the right thing. I mean, imagine what that's really like under the circumstances. But I think he's kept good people at, for example, EPA. So good, in fact, that this latest continuing authorization funding bill that passed the Congress cut EPA way back. They were so concerned that EPA might actually do something. But he's going out on a number of fronts in air quality protection and water and other things. So I think he will accumulate quite a good record. And I think climate is now finally part of that.
Okay. Then as long as we're talking about this general issue and as long as we're talking about fracking is certainly allied to the issue that we're talking about. It's part of it. When I mentioned earlier the new governor of Texas being to the right of Rick Perry, Greg Abbott, today came out saying that he thought that, Denton outlawed fracking in the recent elections, Denton, Texas. He came out saying that basically, he thought that cities should not have the right to do that, to outlaw fracking, to outlaw plastic bags like Austin has, because it's an infringement on personal liberties, personal property rights, and things like that. So I think that kind of thing is going to cause some backlash.
What does he think about earthquakes?
We really can't try to extend the logic. there's no logic to the. I'm putting together a list of other things that relate to personal property rights in the city, and whether if that's an absolute that people should be able to do anything they want to on their own property or with their own property, that offers all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah,
but
I think that the jury's still out to. To some degree on what's causing the tremors in Texas and elsewhere in the country where there has been a lot of fracking. But my hunch and my guess, prediction, is that it will be solidly linked to fracking at some point.
Yeah, so far there's some pretty good, as they say, anecdotal evidence. I know in the Dallas area, they just last week had a number of tremors that had people kind of, jumping under their desks or something. So
yeah, something's happening.
Something's going on.
I put one caveat on my comment about Obama's record. I think his sort of all of the above energy policy is quite misguided. He has encouraged a lot of oil exploration and offshore drilling and and other things, you know, and leasing of federal lands. And it really is a that I think is the and that relates, of course, to the climate issue. And that's you know, that's the biggest flaw I see in his record on the environment.
Yeah, that certainly has to be true. You know, one of the arguments about Obama, and of course many of us who, you know, maybe even reluctantly critically supported him and were then greatly disappointed for a number of reasons, but we always have to look at what he can do and what he does based upon, you know, the just say no atmosphere in the Congress and from the right wing. Which, of course, have caused it. So, and I would have to think that that's moved him in certain directions that he might not have moved otherwise. But there are others who feel that's who he is anyway. So,
well, I think
he's always been a triangulator, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think that under the you know much better circumstances, the kind of circumstances that you know John Kennedy had. You know, he could have been a really great president, a transformational president. But they decided first out of the gate that they were going to block everything he did or try to.
Okay.
And,
well, yeah, go ahead.
It's been brutal. It's been brutal to be president in this era.
Okay, it's about time for us to take a break, and I think this would be actually a good time to do it before we start talking about the book. And I want to say that we're not going to just talk about this book, which is a memoir, but it's also a memoir of, I don't know, not only the environmental movement, but sort of social change in the United States since 1950s or something. So I think it's a fascinating book, and it's a way to talk about all the things that you've done. So we'll be back in just a minute. My guest is environmental activist Gus Speth, and I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.
Up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. Charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on the apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz, did Joni Mitchell just call a cab?
I thought I saw
a cab outside.
Yeah, classic environmental song, since we were talking about the environmental there.
Well, thank you so much. I want to say that my guest again on Rag Radio is James Gustav Speth, Gus Speth, who, according to Bill McKibben, is the great environmentalist of our age. And Gus's book is Angels by the River, a memoir, his most recent book. Okay, Gus, welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
All right. Where did you go?
To the Vermont snows.
Okay. Angels by the River is very interesting, especially because it you kind of go through the trajectory of your life. You start with your life as a child in Greensboro, South Carolina, and which is very interesting. And one of the things that you deal with as the story goes on is certainly there's a lot of explicit racism, but also the kind of implicit racism that you grew up with and didn't even know you were growing up with. Of course, the explicit racism came to a head with the Greensboro Massacre, which was one of the truly tragic events of the civil rights movement. But how you tied in race and the environment in your politics, in your view. Tell me a little bit about how that, and I also want to talk about the industrialization of the South in a minute and what that did in terms of the environment. But tell me a little bit about how that informed, how the racism informed your politics.
Well, I have to make a small correction first. It's easy to get confused because we were talking about a different color. This little town was called Orangeburg that I grew up in.
Oh, but you were all right. I'm sorry.
And it's in the low country of South Carolina where there's the land sort of occasionally seeps up above the water, and it was thoroughly segregated. Everything that you can imagine was segregated. The racial barrier was brutal, and it was sharp and it's extraordinarily demeaning. But I grew up in a household where, we were respectful and didn't see any real, racial violence or hatred. And it was a very sheltered upbringing. And it wasn't really until I went to Yale and got some sense knocked into my head that I realized that, this was extraordinarily bad situation that was existing in the South. And of course, I was in college right when the civil rights movement was taking off in the early 60s. And when I graduated, we actually gave an honorary degree to Martin Luther King, who had just been bailed out of prison in St. Augustine, to come up for the graduation. So that was all part of my life. And I think all during college and then in graduate school and law school, this was the period in which the civil rights movement was making these huge gains, and it was extraordinarily. And we saw as young people what could be done if people were willing to protest, if people were willing to demonstrate, if people were willing to risk something. And we saw what could be done in the courts, and it became very relevant in law school. We saw this great litigation being brought by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and others, and changing the face of the South. And we saw what legislation could do. We could get Washington to finally move, and we did in civil rights in 64 and 1965 with the Voting Rights Act. And so that was the inspiration for us when we were in law school, and we said, well, we don't really want to go to work in a traditional big law firm. What can we do that would promote the general welfare, that will help people and help the future with our law degrees. And our inspiration was to create something, an NAACP Legal Defense Fund for the environment. And I remember thinking one day when I was riding on the train into New York City and reading the New York Times, there was a story about the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. This has been about 1967. And there was another story about some environmental issue. The word environment was hardly used at that time in the way we think of it now. But it probably was the evolution of the National Environmental Policy Act in the Congress. And it occurred to me, yes, we need an NAACP Legal Defense Fund for the environment. So I got some friends together at law school, and we decided to work to create this thing. By 1970, the Natural Resources Defense Council was launched. And looking back, I can see now the way that we were, powerfully influenced by the fight for racial justice in the country. And one of the great tragedies, also looking back, is the way that even though we were influenced that way, you know, we didn't make a big effort to reach out to the minority communities in our country at that time. We didn't make a big effort to reach out to Black America, and we you know, and those it was a good bit later that the environmental movement finally realized that they were neglecting a big part of the public and were an all too white and middle class movement. So that began to change eventually, thank goodness. I don't think it's changed enough, but it is changing. And we can talk about that a bit if you'd like. But anyhow, it was, we were children of the 60s when we were able to, you know, come together for the first Earth Day in 1970. And it, it was a period, and you know, it was in a way the environmental movement was a continuing thrust of a lot of the things that happened in the 60s, and thank goodness for that momentum. So I'm extremely grateful to those pioneers.
It's interesting when you talk about your life and talk about, you know, your career, as it were. I guess one thing, how much you were kind of a rowdy kid. There's a wonderful article that called The Unbearable Politeness of Being Gus Speth, which is
you've done your research.
From Other Words, and you are overly courteous in one being, I guess, in recognizing all those others around you who and their contributions, and also not exactly being self-deprecating, but it's certainly in being. But what you've done was pretty spectacular. And as a kid, you were apparently a little bit more than a cut-up. In fact, you talked about the fact that today's world, you might have been sent away to something to a place for emotionally troubled youth.
In my day, it was being sent off to a military academy somewhere instead of a regular high school.
And that's what scared you straight, huh?
It did. It was certainly contributed when my parents threatened me with that. And there were other things that helped straighten me out. But there's no doubt that I was unruly and a problem for my parents growing up, and undoubtedly for other people too. I say in the memoir that it developed the idea a bit that it left me and perhaps others with a bit of a sense of guilt, sort of nagging guilt, and in a way I feel like I'm psychoanalyzing myself here a bit, but I feel like all the things I've tried to do, in a sense, have been to set the record straight and to do something positive in the world, rather than put chewed up red jelly beans in my mother's olives that she was serving her guests. You know,
and you did a lot more that you talk about, and it's a lot of fun to read it. But I thought that in this, and I've got a number of things that I found that are very interesting, is stuff that's written about you or that you've written. But from this Other Words piece, they say Angels by the River conveys his memories of growing up bright, rambunctious, and white in segregated Orangeburg, and I apologize for that mistake, South Carolina. That heritage still echoes in Speth's lilting Southern accent after more than half a century of living north of the Mason-Dixon line. You're living in Vermont, and you said that you keep going further north and further east as you do. And that you said that something interesting you said, that you find that in some ways Vermont, the environment is kind of what the South was, or what the South actually could have been.
I think so. I think they're probably
lacking the diversity.
Lacking the diversity, for sure. The second least diverse state in the country. I've wondered what's the most diverse. I wonder, Wyoming? I don't know what it is, actually. I think there are a lot of places in our country where people are more rooted. There's a very powerful sense of community, as there is here in Vermont and as there was in Orangeburg when I was growing up. There's a reverence for the natural world, really, And, you know, people look after each other and try to do things in a different way. You know, you can think of it as a more agrarian lifestyle, as some do. There's this movement for a new agrarianism in our country that people associate Wendell Berry prominently with, and others. But it is a, I think we landed in part for a variety of reasons in a place in here in Vermont that's that is similar to the to the South in a lot of ways that used to be. This commercial bulldozer has rolled over the South for the entire duration of my life.
Good. You're going where I wanted you to go.
Yeah. Because well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's just been it's been dramatic change. I mean, it's gone from a very rural society, a very rooted society, a very agricultural society, to the point that at one point South Carolina had the second highest manufacturing employment per capita in the country, and now it's you know it is a culture that seems dedicated to growth and of any type, more laissez-faire than the rest of the country, and they're remnants of the old in the old you know culture of the South there, but it's been turned in you know for this so-called progress that we've had, which is really a very materialistic, a very commercial culture that has taken over, and a lot of the old culture of the South of the early decades of this century has gone, and some of that's for the better. I don't pretend otherwise. It was very poor, and the racial issues were quite dramatic and unfortunate.
But they're still there in the politics. Aren't they?
The politics is really, you know, unfortunately, you know, I don't like being partisan, but I know because when we started the environmental issue and we made progress in the 70s, it was very bipartisan, and Senator Ed Muskie was joined constantly with Senator Howard Baker and John Sherman Cooper and other Republican leaders, but it's gotten to the point now that you know, it's hard to find a progressive soul in the Republican Party, and it's certainly hard to find, not impossible, but pretty hard to find a Democrat who doesn't have a good environmental voting record. There are a few. So this transformation, I mean, Vermont now, of course, used to be deeply Republican. The whole of New England did. And now we have what may be the most progressive delegation in the Congress, and a pretty solidly Democratic. And the South is South Carolina was recently in a study done by some political scientists who was determined to be the most Republican state in the country. My home, you couldn't find a Republican down there, at least who could vote. In my youth, so there's been this transformation in the country towards partisanship. I mean, everything is more partisan, even where people live, and the parties have become much more sharply defined. And in the Republican case, they've gone off the. In my view, I say I hate to be partisan, but it's true. They've gone off the deep end on the climate issue and others that I've worked on all my life. The majority of Republican Party in both houses of Congress is now officially on record as far as climate denial, climate skeptic, and this is so serious because this is our world that we're leaving to our children, and to reject the science on this issue and reject the ignore the effects that are already happening with just moderate global average warming. It is such a tragedy. It is the worst thing. You know, I say in the memoir that it's the, you know, greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic. We are ruining the planet and the opportunities for, you know, well-being of our children. So, another, you know, part of this, Thorne, that resonates with me very powerfully is that we, in the Carter administration, 34 years ago, we put out three reports calling for action on climate change. We do enough over three decades ago to understand the basics of the problem and the need to change our energy policy to deal with it. And we put out reports. They were well reported in the New York Times and other newspapers, the plea for action out of the Carter White House. And, of course, we were turned out in 1980 by the voters. But the point is that this is not something that has sprung up unknown or unannounced. It is an act of almost willful neglect of one of the most serious problems that we've ever faced. And the fossil fuel industry, the companies that are running that industry, the leaders of it, these are technology-based, science-based institutions. I think they know exactly what's going on. They can get good science whenever they want it, and they know what's happening to the climate and the planet, and they persist in doing it. And not only that, they persist in preventing us from doing anything about it in the Congress. And it's all just to make money. They're in a system where they're just programmed to make money, and they really don't care.
You said that when you worked in the government or in the early days, in any event, of the sort of climate awareness, that federal government was very, very good on the issue.
So this was where you took an issue. You know, we had these state governments that weren't doing anything much about civil rights or about climate or any other progressive cause, consumerism. So, you know, if you were Ralph Nader or an environmental leader in 1970 or civil rights leader as Martin Luther King, I'm dying to see the Selma film, you know, you would want to get to Washington. The possibility of progressive action that would cover the whole nation was very real, and Washington was a positive, and federal action was viewed as positive for the most part, and you know, we are under the powerful influence of this anti-Washington, anti-regulation, anti-government ideology. And when you combine that with the, you know, powerful economic interests that involve, you know, that want to persist in using that 80% of our fossil resource that should stay in the ground, you've got a force to for the status quo or worse that is going to be very hard to beat. And if we progressives stay isolated in our silos and don't get more organized and together and active and activist, we won't beat it.
Okay.
But imagine what would happen if almost by accident we had Occupy at its highest moment, and then we had this 400,000 person march in New York City for climate justice, and we had the Ferguson risings around the country, and somehow that had all happened in about the same time, you could begin to see a coming together of progressive forces that might actually, take back our politics and reassert the ascendancy of people power over money power, and begin to get some of the deep changes that we need in our country.
I think, and we're going to need to take a break again here. The time flies when you're having fun. But one of the problems is that there haven't been really significant organizers and organizations that have tried to tie issues together and look at systemic causes and who would be able to lead, you know, one of the problems with the Occupy movement was that it was so afraid of any kind of leadership and any kind of involvement in politics and on whatever, you know, level,
right.
However you might call it.
No, it was a, yep.
Yes, you're right. There has been an awful lot of activism, but it's usually been around single issues. So, okay, we need to take a break. My guest is environmentalist Gus Speth and author of Angels by the River, a memoir. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.
We were hungry, just barely alive. By May the 10th, Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the people were singing. They
okay, now that we've driven old Dixie down, I'm Thorne Dreyer, Rag Radio. My guest is Gus Speth. What I'd like to do in this last segment, and we have about probably 13 minutes left is all, is that I want you to talk a little bit about the stuff that you did, especially, because y'all did some very significant things and started dealing with issues that no one had dealt with before, especially when you started the Natural Resources Defense Council. And on, tell us a little bit about what that was like. And I want to take you then from sort of being a mainstream environmentalist into your sort of radicalization, whether you want to call it that or not, and seeing the, when we talk about issues being tied together, seeing about how the problems, you know, to have to some extent, we have to look at market capitalism, we have to look at the industrial complex, we have to look at larger issues and how things are put, but that we have to make basic kind of changes, before we can change the environment and before we can deal with climate change. I don't think I'm saying anything that you don't believe. First tell us a little bit about how those issues were first raised and first brought to the public.
Well, we were young and a little bit crazy when we started the Natural Resources Defense Council, and we were, inventing things as we went along. It was quite a formative period, but we brought lawsuits, for example, that extended the protection of the Clean Water Act to wetlands, inland wetlands in the United States. It's still controversial today, but we protect that result. It didn't, a lot of protection of freshwater wetlands in our country, and we challenged the breeder reactor program, which was promised to usher in hundreds of a new generation of nuclear power reactors that were more dangerous than the earlier ones, and finally took that into the Carter administration, where Jimmy Carter killed it off. Carter, I think, I worked for him for 4 years. I have a great admiration for him. I think he was the most environmental president we've ever had, in the sense of just being understanding it in his heart and in his gut. And I kept moving from really exciting, demanding positions, and was very fortunate in that regard. But then I went to Yale, and I was the dean of the Environment School there, but I had a chance to step back and begin to reflect on, well, where do we really stand after 30-some-odd years since Earth Day? And I realized that, we were winning a lot of battles, but we were losing the planet. We were losing biodiversity and natural areas and climate and public health in a huge way, despite all the accomplishments and despite our growing strength and numbers and budgets. And NRDC had grown to an organization of over $100 million a year budget, and yet here we are on the cusp of losing the planet. So I began to think, well, what in the world is behind this? How could this be? How did this paradox come about? And you know, and I began to research it and look further into it. And the further I looked, the harder I looked, I began to see that this was really that this environmental degradation was driven by, in effect, a system of political economy, an operating system that was programmed for certain results, great profits, GDP growth, a projection of national power, but it wasn't programmed, you know, for people and place and planet, and we were getting, you know, it was basically a system that was out of control from our point of view, from the point of view of what people really need and what the planet really needs and the places that we live. So I began to think that, you know, the real issue here is to combine this continuing incremental reform that NRDC fights for every day still with a deeper critique of the system that we're in, and to begin to promote system change across a wide front, new types of corporations, new corporations that are governed differently, that are more rooted and more social enterprise, new values. Because if we don't have a value transformation beyond this materialism and anthropocentrism that we have today, we won't make it. A critique of growth. We worship GDP, but it hasn't done us that much good, actually, in recent decades. Wages have stagnated. Inequality has climbed to levels we haven't seen since the 20s. Social mobility is about the worst in the rich country world. Poverty is at it was at an all-time high in terms of numbers. You know, education problems, health problems, you know, with the bottom falling out of the middle class, all that in the teeth of a lot of GDP growth. So we need to think about a different approach and one that deals more systemically at the root causes of our problems. But another thing I looked at, Thorne, was, it wasn't just environment that was taking a hit, that was going south. If you look at where we stand in education and health and social mobility and poverty and equality and treatment of children and a host of issues, we're at the bottom or near the bottom, and environmental performance at or near the bottom of the so-called old OECD, the 20 advanced industrial democracies. We're at the bottom now. So when you have problems emerging across the whole front of national life and the economy and the society and in our politics and environment, it's not due to some neglect here or something we didn't do there. When you have those kind of problems emerging across the whole front of national life, it's due to the fact that we have a system of political economy that's not dealing with these issues, that's dealing with other priorities. So, you know, we need to identify the changes that are needed to move us to a new system of political economy, beyond the old socialism, beyond today's rapacious capitalism, but a new system that we can create. And we know a lot about how to move that forward and the things that are needed. And we know what we need to do to salvage our politics from this creeping plutocracy and corporatocracy that we have. And my books, including the memoir that you've been kind to mention, deal with these issues and the directions that I think we need to take and some of the policy measures that we need to pursue. I'm sure some people will say, well, that's very radical, and it is radical by today's political standards, which has moved so far to the right. But it's really not very far from where Franklin Roosevelt was when I was two, and he gave his speech about an economic bill of rights for our country.
Right.
Which just add some environment to that list, which they didn't really appreciate back then. You know, you would have a program that we ought to go forward with today.
Daniel Berman reviewed your earlier, your 2012 book, America the Possible Manifesto for a New Economy, in the Monthly Review, when he said Speth's breathtaking admission of the futility of, he referred to your breathtaking admission of the futility of expecting change from working inside the establishment. He quotes your decision to make, to get arrested at the Keystone demonstration. So after more than 30 years of unsuccessfully advocating for government action to protect our planet's climate, I found myself at the end of my proverbial rope. Civil disobedience was my way of saying that America's economic and political system had failed us all. Okay, what do we do? How do we move forward? What kind of new, and Gus Speth is my guest, by the way, just to let everybody, environmentalist. How do we move forward? What's a new environmentalism?
One question is,
and we have less than 5 minutes.
We need to ask again, what's an environmental issue? And the traditional way of answering that is air pollution, water pollution, climate, so on. But what if you say that an environmental issue is whatever really determines our success in protecting the environment? What affects environmental results, outcomes? And once you answer that question that way, you see right away that our politics, our failing democracy, is critical to environmental success and other areas of success. You see that this vast social insecurity in our country is a huge impediment to environmental progress. People are scared. They're losing jobs. They're getting crummy jobs. Their incomes aren't going up, but their costs are, and the bottom is falling out of the middle class, and people are desperate and very worried, and half the families in the country just living paycheck to paycheck. That's a huge impediment to environmental progress, and our values are so materialistic and consumerist, that's another huge impediment. But these are issues that the environmental community really doesn't deal with that much. It doesn't really go after our politics, and it doesn't threaten. It doesn't challenge us to change our values and our lifestyles. And it's not working to create a new system of corporations that are different from the ones that we have today, and to propose the deep changes that will rein in the big corporations, which we know a lot about. National charters and other things that could be used to do that. So,
what about alliances with the labor movement? I know that.
Well, this is a huge problem because this environmental community has badly neglected its outreach with minority communities, with the labor community, and we have so much in common. Yes, I know that there are issues that the labor parts of labor is favoring Keystone, and there are bound to be some conflicts. There have been, but there was a day when we worked very closely with labor in the 70s, and working people in this country, know they're getting a raw deal. They know the system is rigged against them, and it's that system that we have to join together to change. I think Elizabeth Warren is spot on when she says the system is rigged against us, and so we have to change the system, and we know a lot about how to do that. There are two great things though. One is, we can bring the future into the present in our communities. And maybe a lot of that's going on in Austin, but there are places all over the country where people are doing remarkable things at the local level. And the other thing is, we need to join together, whether we're right or central or left, to reform our politics, to save our democracy before we're too late. And we know a lot about the political reforms that we need to do that. So those are two doors that are open to us.
Okay, so in 1 minute now, so many people look now at climate change, and it seems almost futile. It seems like we've almost gone too far, and they see our political system and don't see how, and the world political system, because we're the world economy, because, so what, that maybe it's hopeless, and that makes a lot of people get very discouraged. What reason, what do you see, what cause do you see for hope?
Well, I think, just on the climate issue, putting the hope issue to one side for a second, climate is going to be very serious for future generations regardless. But unless we act on it and act dramatically and swiftly and urgently on it, it's going to be a hell of a lot worse. This is not the, as someone said, things are too bad for pessimism.
That doesn't get us anywhere, does it?
But I see a lot of hope. You mentioned earlier about organizations. I mean, we are seeing the organizations.
20 seconds.
We're seeing a lot of organizations coming around this theme of developing a new economy. We're seeing a lot of activism. We're seeing a lot of confluence, as we did in that 400,000 person march in New York, which was not just a bunch of intellectual climate activists, but people who are concerned about gender issues and all kinds of other issues coming together. So things are moving in the country.
Okay, we got to go. And we're going to do this again. We're going to do this again. Gus Beth, thank you so much for being with us on Rag Radio.
Thank you, Thorne.
It's been great. Coming up soon, Victor Picard, Jonah Raskin, Bob McChesney, and jazz and swing singer Mary Ann Price. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.